Matthew 23, Part 2. The fifth talk about Jesus' teaching on Phariseeism was presented by Jack Crabtree on September 11, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, I was a little frustrated last week in getting everything said that I think could be said about Matthew 23, so I want to spend a little bit more time with Matthew 23 and not go back to Luke. I may, depending upon how it goes, I may take next week as well. I've organized my thoughts here in my notes, so I'm either going to be disorganized or note-bound. Four things here that as I go through Matthew 23, there are four things that I'm contending, and I don't know that they involve not just an interpretation of the Scripture, but they involve an interpretation of our times and of our culture, and so I may or may not be right about this, and I'm just leaving it for you to consider. But there are four things here that I want us to keep in mind to ask ourselves whether or not this is not the case. My contention first is that Phariseeism, which is what Matthew 23 is about, Phariseeism, it seems to me, is the natural religion of mankind. As I look at different philosophies and different religions across the world, they share a whole lot in common in many respects, but there's one thing about Christianity that seems to me makes it absolutely unique, and it's its straightforward, realistic appraisal of the human condition and of human nature. It's unqualified judgment that human beings are evil and perverse. That seems to me to be truly unique. There are other religions accommodate sin. They have a concept of sin, but their concept of sin is not, it doesn't go as deep. It's not as profound an appraisal of the human condition as you find in Jesus and the apostles. So anything that denies that is the antithesis of the gospel, it seems to me. And Phariseeism, by its very nature, is one manifestation of the rejection of that appraisal of the human being. So that's the basis upon which I think Phariseeism is sort of the antithesis of the gospel on the one hand. Actually, that's my second contention. It's the antithesis of the gospel on the one hand, and because it's the antithesis of the gospel and attractive to sinful, rebellious creatures, it's the natural religion of mankind. Third contention is that Phariseeism is ultimately a destructive and toxic religion. It destroys people. It's not a benign and ignorant mistake. I think I've spent most of my life as a Christian thinking of Phariseeism as this sort of benign, ignorant, quaint, old-fashioned way of looking at things, and I should try not to be proud in relationship to Pharisees, but there's nothing particularly dangerous about it. The more I've lived, the more I've seen, the more I've interacted with people, the more I've seen Phariseeism at work, it seems to me that Jesus, when he warned his disciples against the leaven of the Pharisees, I mean, I don't know that he gave any more frequent warnings to anybody than he did warning people against Phariseeism. And I think there's a reason for that, because Phariseeism is a destructive and toxic religion. The Pharisee is not someone who ought to be tolerated as a misguided brother. The Pharisee is someone who ought to be evangelized, persuaded of the goodness of the good news of the gospel taught by Jesus. Now, I'm not on a crusade to go burn Pharisees at the stake. You know, we don't need to be obnoxious and violent in our response. We're supposed to be loving. But my contention is we don't tolerate it as an acceptable form of Christianity. We recognize that those are people who need to know the good news and therefore need to be persuaded of that good news, evangelized. So my third contention is that it's a destructive and toxic religion. It's not a benign and ignorant mistake. And the fourth one is that Phariseeism in one form or another prevails in world Christian culture today. So much so, I would argue, that the cultures of Christianity can aptly be said to be Pharisaical in their fundamental tenor. So our institutions, our practices, the language we use, the things we say to one another, the value systems that we absorb and have adopted from our Christian surroundings, all of that is fundamentally Pharisaical in its tenor rather than truly Christian, authentically informed by the teaching of Jesus. That's my contention. And if you put my last two contentions together, then hence the Christianity of world Christian culture today has become a destructive and toxic religion. Now, I realize that's a fairly extreme statement, and you'll likely want to dismiss that as, well, that's Jack. And that could be true. It could be me. But I don't mean that as a frivolous claim. I don't mean that as hyperbole. I mean that for something to seriously consider, that that's possible, that we have become a destructive and toxic religion. There's nothing more annoying to me than the secular culture out there making comments about how hypocritical Christians are. I mean, there's nothing more annoying to me. Like they're not. And because it shows such complete misunderstanding of what the Bible teaches, what Jesus taught, what the apostles teach, and so on. But I have to wonder, are they not responding to something that's really there? That you and I, of course, I think, live in a fairly sane bubble of Christianity compared to a lot of the stuff that's out there in the United States. And the more I begin to see that culture peeking through into people's lives, the more I begin to wonder how much of this Christianity out there is even Christian. How much of it even understands and tries to do business with the teaching of Jesus and the gospel revealed by Jesus. I have to begin to wonder seriously whether a casual observation of Christian culture is not accurately grasped by the secular world as this destructive and toxic thing that we have concocted because it's shot through with this Phariseeism that Jesus is criticizing in Matthew 23. Maybe I'm wrong, but I, you know, my experience in recent years has raised that as a serious question. So I want to look at Jesus' discourse here in Matthew 23 point by point, and I'm going to try to relate it to today as best I can, but I need your help. I want to leave time for your comments and questions and maybe some of your observations about any parallels that might exist or that don't exist. I mean, take me on and argue with me if you think I have not rightly assessed Christian culture today. Well, the first point is in verses 2 and 3. Some of this is going to be review, but I'll do it quickly. In 2 and 3, he says, or 1, then Jesus spoke to the crowds and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds, for they say things and do not do them." I went over that extensively last week. He's simply telling his followers that the Pharisees are absolutely right in the bald statement of their message, namely, that we must keep the covenant that God made with Israel in the time of Moses. That's the underlying claim that they're making. All of you people, keep the law of Moses. Question came up last week. I will use the word law and covenant synonymously. I'm not making a distinction. The law of Moses is the covenant of Moses, or the Mosaic covenant. We must keep the covenant that God made with Israel. That's our responsibility. He says, insofar as that's their instruction to you, yes, do it. They're right about that. But he says, the Pharisees are completely wrong in the way that they are attempting to do that. In the way that they're attempting to keep that covenant with Moses, they're wrong. So Jesus says, keep the covenant in, don't keep the covenant in the way that they claim to keep it. You must really keep it. Not do it as they do it, but do it the way God intended it to be done. So that's all he's saying in 2 and 3. Now, of course, that's a radical claim at this time, because he's basically charging the Pharisees with disloyalty and unfaithfulness to the very covenant that they are arguing we need to be faithful and loyal to. So it's a very radical claim that he's making. In the rest of the chapter, then, Jesus spells out some of the ways in which the way the Pharisees are doing it is wrong, that they're not really keeping the covenant. Now, to help clarify things, for many of you, this will be review, but for some of you who are new to these ideas, I think it's important to ask this question. What was God's intent in the Mosaic covenant? What did he intend? Did God intend the Israelites to keep the covenant? Or did God know that they would not keep it, and that their failure to keep it, by that failure to keep it, they would be led to an understanding of their need for mercy and their lack of moral worth? Many of us were raised in a tradition that answered it in the last way. I for half my life as a Bible teacher, I taught that God sent the law, the Mosaic law, as a kind of divine joke. Here, you want eternal life? Do this, ha ha. No way are you going to be able to keep this. So, by not keeping it, God is using it as a pedagogical device to drive me to an awareness of how immoral I am, how perverse I am, how depraved I am. And then the answer is offered later in history in Jesus. Jesus is the answer to your lack of moral worth that's been made manifest to you by your failure to keep the covenant. Well, that was before I read the Old Testament. Then I went back and read the Old Testament, and that wasn't working. You know, that's just not the way it goes down in Deuteronomy. It's not the way it goes down in Exodus. It's just not what's happening. You can't read those without recognizing that from God's perspective, the covenant is eminently keepable. Yes, you can keep the covenant. The point that Jesus and the apostles are making is more subtle than that. Yes, you can keep the covenant, and you should keep the covenant. It's not by failing to keep the covenant that you will come to recognize your lack of moral worth. It's by keeping the covenant that you will come to recognize your lack of moral worth. Because if you keep the covenant, there's no way to keep the covenant without there being a trail of blood from your house to the temple, from your house to the altar. Because within the covenant is provision for sin offerings, guilt offerings, all these things that you must do when you have failed, when you have been unworthy, when you have broken some other aspect of the covenant. You can be set right as a covenant keeper by offering the appropriate offering, but you can only be set right as a covenant keeper if you do offer the appropriate offering. Well, you got to be pretty dense. If you, you have to be pretty blind, pretty willfully blind, if at the end of your life, you look back at your life and you pat yourself on the back because you are a covenant keeper and you say, God must be pleased with me, I am a good person. I am a morally worthy person. Because there's that trail of blood that says otherwise. There's that trail of blood that says, Look at all those perverse desires. Look at all those perverse words that came out of your mouth. Look at the cruelty, the injustice, the dishonesty, the lack of love, the lack of compassion, the lack of mercy. All that stuff that you had to ultimately acknowledge and confess and offer up a sin or guilt offering for. Look at all that stuff. What kind of person are you? And so in the very process of keeping the covenant, you come to know yourself in a way that you would never know yourself if you had never even attempted to keep the covenant. I don't know how much of my life I lied to myself saying, well, yeah, I'm not a perfect person, but then I'm not trying real hard either. And it's easy then to lie to yourself and say, well, fundamentally, basically, I'm a good person. I just need to buckle up and try harder. It's only when you finally buckle up and try harder and you still can't be a good person that you begin to know who you are. You are actually depraved and perverse. Well, that's what God intended in the Mosaic Covenant. He intended in the Mosaic Covenant that by taking Him seriously and therefore taking His covenant seriously, people would become confronted with the reality of how twisted and broken they are morally. And then they would be prepared to understand, appreciate, acknowledge, and receive the mercy of God if they would. But not until then. Okay. I think that's an important point, but my notes don't tell me how that connects to anything. So what about today? Notice Jesus' message. Pharisees say to keep the covenant. They're absolutely right. Do it. Take the Mosaic covenant very seriously. It's a very serious matter. But many modern Christians have theologies that encourage them to not take the Mosaic covenant seriously, out of a heart condition reminiscent of that of the New Testament Pharisees. I've seen many a Christian whose underlying attitude was, I didn't love my neighbor. Yeah, oh well. Isn't it wonderful that we no longer have to keep the law to be saved? I mean, and take any sin, take any moral failing. We see and acknowledge the moral failing on the one hand, but then we say, well, you know, that's, if I were a Jew, I'd be sunk. But I'm not a Jew, I'm a Christian, so no, we don't have to keep the law any longer, that's okay. But by all rights, their failure to love their neighbor or whatever their failure is should lead them to mourn, to grieve their moral depravity, and should lead them ultimately to hunger and thirst for the righteousness that they lack. That's how a heart for God would respond in the midst of the moral failure. But instead, all too often in Christian culture, encouraged by our own theology, our response is one of kind of a dismissive attitude. I'm a sinner, yeah. Yeah, I am. No big deal, really. My theology tells me Jesus took care of that or something. It's not the appropriate response. The appropriate response is to feel my brokenness, to see my brokenness from deep inside and long to be other than that, long to be changed, long to be made different one day. As if Christianity were something about something other than righteousness. And I would argue that for most of Christian culture, I think Christianity is about something other than righteousness. It's about success. It's about happiness. It's about comfort and safety in this world. And Jesus, my invisible friend, will put a protective bubble around me that will keep me safe and comfortable. Something in some such form as that. But we've in doing that, we've transformed Christianity beyond recognition. It's no longer anything Jesus and the apostles would recognize. Okay? Second point he makes is in 4, and I want to spend a little bit more time on that. It says, they tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. And I suggested a different way of translating that last week, a different way of looking at that. And a good question was raised about that I want to address, if I could. But in my notes, I think it comes later. So let me get there in due time. Jesus claims that the Pharisees, through their teaching and their attitude, crush people by ladening them with a truly impossible task. Namely, the impossible task is, you guys prove yourself worthy of God through your conformity to the requirements of the covenant. Go out there, look at the covenant, see what it requires, and do it in such a way that you prove yourself worthy of God. That's the task. Well, given what God tells us about the nature of human beings, that's an impossible task. I am inherently not worthy of God. I am fundamentally broken. I am fundamentally perverse, twisted in my moral nature. And I am fundamentally, therefore, unworthy by the very nature of who I am at the deepest level of my being. So to say to someone who's fundamentally and inherently unworthy, make yourself and show yourself and prove yourself worthy, is like saying, touch the moon. It's not going to happen. It's impossible. So the Pharisees are laying that crushing burden on people by their teaching and their own attitudes, and yet they themselves do not even have an authentic desire to perform even the least little portion of that very same task. That's what I understand Jesus to be saying in this passage. The heavy burden, don't misunderstand what Jesus is saying here. The heavy burden is not the multiplication of rules in the Pharisaical tradition. For years, that's the way I read it, is that you have the Mosaic covenant, and then you have the Pharisees coming along adding hundreds or thousands more rules, and that becomes just a heavy burden. I don't think that's Jesus' point. Jesus' point is not, this is an incredible inconvenience. I think his point is, this is an impossible, crushing burden. Well, the Pharisees didn't experience their traditions as an impossible, crushing burden. They did it. They kept it. If you know any Orthodox Jews will tell you how inconvenient keeping the law is. But it's an inconvenience that they will gladly bear for God and for their unique relationship with God. Sinners can be inconvenienced. We can bear with inconvenience. That's not what Jesus is talking about. What Jesus is talking about is the impossibility of this task that actually crushes you, destroys you by the weight of this burden. So I don't think it's the multiplied rules. The Pharisaical mindset that makes this work for them is their self-deceived presumption of worthiness. A self-deceived person, precisely because of his self-deception, has no interest in proving his worth of divine blessing. His worth is not an issue for him. He already believes in his own worth. He takes his worth for granted. It's not an existential crisis or an issue for him. Of course God will bless him. Why would he not? I mean, if you're anything like me, growing up in the Christian tradition, that was my attitude for years. I mean, I looked at all kinds of trivial differences between me and my pagan neighbors, and those trivial differences, I weighted them very highly in my mind, and in my mind, it made it obvious to me that I was worthy of God. I was a good person, and they were sinners. Well, that's the mindset of the Pharisee. It's not even a live issue for him whether or not he's going worthy of the divine blessing. Of course he is. That's settled in his mind. That was part of what God intended for the law of Moses, was to create an existential crisis where there hadn't been one before in the individual heart. Namely, God, I am an evil man, unable to make myself worthy of you. How can I live? To raise the existential question, how can I enter into life, is what the purpose of the law was, I think, in the individual being. If one would take God seriously enough to take his covenant seriously and attempt to truly keep it, he would be able to do so. But in the process of doing so, he would tote a whole lot of animal blood to the altar. And in his carrying all that blood to the altar, the man who was open to truth and reality would be taught what a depraved and unworthy creature he was. I'm sorry, I'm just repeating that. So the Pharisaical mindset, in the Pharisee's mind, interest in the demands of the law are extrinsic, not intrinsic. I'll define what I mean by that. That is, the Pharisee has no desire to keep the requirements of the law because of their intrinsic value and meaning. The Pharisee wants to keep the requirements of the law to the extent and only to the extent that they can serve him in his own fundamentally self-serving purposes. We're going to see this as we go on in the next several verses. I think this is exactly what Jesus is getting at. The Pharisee doesn't want to love his neighbor because he's been captivated by the vision of what a beautiful kind of person it would be to be the kind of person who loves your neighbor. That's not intrinsically interesting to the Pharisee. The reason the Pharisee would take the commandment to love your neighbor seriously is because it has some kind of social currency. I can communicate to you what a good person I am if I keep a commandment that you recognize as indicative of righteousness. That's why Phariseeism always tends to not look at things like loving your neighbor. You know, notice that's never a part of the Pharisaical tradition that comes out in Jesus' interaction with the Pharisees. It doesn't describe a Pharisee as fasting three times a week, praying three times a day, and loving his neighbor. It doesn't describe him that way. It's always in religious, ceremonial, relatively trivial terms that you define the Pharisee as a Pharisee. And the same is certainly true in Christian culture today. We define people's spirituality by what they look like on the outside. How do they dress? How do they talk? Do they talk with rough, bad language or refined, civilized, decent language? Do they use a lot of pious language in their speech? Do they talk about God with reverence? Do they have that false, strained sincerity whenever they say the word Jesus? I mean, there's all kinds of devices that we use to communicate to others and therefore ultimately to ourselves, to communicate how serious, how sincere, how fervent I am in my love for God and my desire to obey Him. But it's all out here. It's all stuff for public consumption. It's all stuff that's out there to persuade you that I'm righteous. So all those requirements of the law, to the extent that they have that kind of public social currency, the Pharisees interested in them. But if they don't have any public social currency, the Pharisee is not interested in them because, frankly, he's not interested in any of it inherently. It's not its intrinsic value that attracts him. It's its self-serving. It's its value for his self-serving purposes. So I think that's why Jesus puts it the way he does, that the Pharisees do not even want to prove themselves worthy by keeping the law. They don't even want to do that, really. Jesus is saying it is not merely that the Pharisees, like everyone else they instruct, are unable to bear the impossible burden that they load on people's backs. That's true, but it's not only that. Even more, they don't even have the interest in those things that they, by doing them, would make themselves men or women that are worthy of God. It's not even interesting to them. And I think that's what Jesus is saying in verse 4. In my language, not only are Pharisees fundamentally depraved creatures like every other human being, but they are not even sanctified believers either. For not only are they unable to be good, neither are they authentically interested in being good. So Jesus puts it this way: the Pharisees insist on a message and a theology that crushes people under the burden of an impossible task to be worthy of divine blessing through obedience to the law. But they themselves do not have the slightest interest in that task. They are not interested in being worthy of the divine blessing, not really, for they are not genuinely interested in doing what such a person would do, nor in being what such a person would be. Now, wow. Okay, why do I interpret it in this particular way? Oh, well, I need to be sensitive to the... But let me talk about an alternative. I think the translator, notice, they are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. What it suggests to me is two different parts of their interpretation that differ from mine. First of all, for the translator, to move the burden is not to move my own comparable burden, but to help others move their burden. And that what he's accusing them of is you laden them with this heavy, crushing burden, and you won't help them one bit with this burden that you've loaded on them. I think that's how the translator is looking at it. But if I'm right in what the burden is, that doesn't make sense, because there's no way that one person can help another person bear his burden if the burden is to make himself worthy of God through his obedience to the law. Each person must bear his own burden. If so, if I'm right about that, then Jesus can't be criticizing the Pharisees for not helping someone bear their burden when it's not possible to help somebody else bear their burden. So that couldn't be his criticism, I don't think. So I'm arguing that the reference to a finger is not... Oh, I'm sorry. Right. So I'm arguing that the reference to a finger is to the distance that they are unwilling to bear their own burden, not to the part of the anatomy that they're unwilling to use to bear somebody else's burden. I think that makes more sense to me. See, I am unwilling to help even the slightest bit another person become worthy of the divine blessing, I think the translator is saying. But if I'm right, Jesus wouldn't criticize him for that. It's not possible to help someone accomplish something that is inherently impossible to achieve. So let's go back to my analogy of reaching the moon. Jesus wouldn't criticize me for not allowing someone to stand on my shoulders in order to reach the moon. I mean, if I can't reach the moon, I can't reach the moon. If it's impossible to reach the moon, and I'm not going to try to help you by having you stand on my shoulders. That's absurd. It's just as absurd to try to help someone carry this burden if I'm right about what that burden is. The other aspect of the translator's interpretation, I am unwilling to help another person keep from being crushed by the burden of this impossible task by lightening the load somewhat. It seems to me that the translator is saying, well, okay, maybe you can't help them carry it, but could you extend your finger to lighten the load a little bit? Well, let's make that plausible. How might that be? Well, by being empathetic and merciful, perhaps. Because now that could be a bona fide criticism. That is, you load this crushing burden on other people, and then you're censorious and judgmental in your attitude toward them, rather than being empathetic and merciful, that they can't do this impossible task. I could see that being a bona fide criticism. Is that what he's saying here? Well, again, I don't think so, because if I'm right in what the burden is, mercy by me doesn't really lighten the burden. The burden still crushes you, no matter how merciful I might be in my attitude toward you. It doesn't make the burden more manageable just because I'm empathetic and merciful. It doesn't make it less onerous just because I'm merciful and empathetic. I ought to be merciful and empathetic, that's true, but it can't be compared to lightening your load. And in fact, in the end, in the gospel, the load does not get lightened, I don't believe. I think the load gets removed. Divine mercy removes the burden. It takes it off of our back altogether rather than lightening the load. The removal of the burden is only something God can do. Another man can't do it for me. So it's difficult to see how Jesus would be critical of the Pharisees for not removing the burden when no human being can remove the burden. Only God can do that. So in the end, I'm left with my original interpretation. It seems to me that not willing to move it even a finger is talking about the Pharisees not being willing to take on that same task for themselves, by themselves, and not only will they not move it, carry it, they won't even budge it an inch, is what he's saying. You are so completely out of the ball game, you're totally unwilling to even be interested in the task at all. Now, there's two responses. I'm leaving the text here. This is me speaking. But there's two responses to the crushing burden of that the Pharisees lay on people. One is the self-deceived, self-righteous hypocrisy that Jesus is attacking in Matthew 23. So if we zoom down to today, today's Phariseeism, even in forms of it that don't look very Pharisaical at all, say your seeker-friendly churches in our culture today, today's Phariseeism is not the fanatical religious legalism of the past. It is a more modern, tame, or I might say insipid, civilized live and let live to demonstrate the love of Jesus type of Phariseeism. What makes it still Phariseeism is it is still founded on the assumption that I am basically capable of being worthy before God. That's the essence of what makes Phariseeism Phariseeism. So if that's the foundation of our culture and our life together and our theology and everything, then that is a Pharisaical culture. So it's still founded on self-deception and self-righteousness. It's still, the second aspect of Phariseeism that still remains, it still hands people a script that it identifies as what it looks like to live a life that would prove one to be worthy. We're still telling people, here's what it looks like to be a Christian. What's the gospel message in most churches today, I think? Come all you who are weary and heavy laden, and we will give you rest. Just live your lives the way we do, and you will find rest for your soul. I mean, isn't that our message? These churches have nothing in the way of good news to offer the person who, for whatever reason, cannot successfully conform to the cultural values of that particular church subculture. And our response to them is, well, tough. You know, you just don't believe. Come and live like we do because we have found rest. And then you find a person who just is not culturally in a position to be able to conform to our culture. And what do we say to them? Well, they, I guess they're just unbelievers. I mean, they just don't want to do this thing. But what we're offering them is not the good news that Jesus brought. We're offering them a cultural solution to a profound personal dilemma. So the message implicitly is just conform and do it like us and look like us, or else we have nothing to offer you. In contrast, the gospel of Jesus Christ is precisely a message of good news to the losers, to the failures, the ones who couldn't do Christianity right. Those are the people who stand to hear good news in the message of Jesus. So, the first response to the crushing burden of the Pharisees' message is self-righteous hypocrisy. The second kind of response is despair. And that's what Jesus is talking about. The Pharisees were actually in a minority in their culture. They were not the majority response. Theirs was the minority response. The majority response were the plain old tax gatherers and sinners in the culture of Palestine. And, sorry, some of you don't like me calling it Palestine. Israel. Judea. Judah. They just had given up. They had despaired. So you zoom down today, it seems to me our churches are full of people who have not accepted the strategy of self-deception that's endemic to Phariseeism. There's some part of them that is just too honest to do that. So they're not going to tell themselves they're good when they can look at their own life and see that they're not good. They're not going to tell themselves that they're worthy when they can look at their own life and see that they're not worthy. So they don't engage in the self-righteous hypocrisy of the Pharisees. What do? They simply despair. And in their despair, they typically hide. As they try to live like good Christians, they fail. And in their failure, they acknowledge that they fail. And instead of telling themselves that they are worthy and arrogantly flaunt it, they simply tried to hide, to not be noticed, and to die inside. That despair, it seems to me, takes a heavy emotional and psychological toll on people. But the question I have to ask myself is, why would people despair rather than, in this day and age, when there's Bibles out there, there are more Bibles than there are any other book in the market. There's Bibles for plumbers, there's Bibles for engineers, there's Bibles for everybody. With all those Bibles out there, why don't we opt for the mercy and grace of God instead of despair? Why not? Well, it seems to me because that's a real problem for us as human beings. As a manifestation of our fundamental sinfulness, our fundamental rebellion against God and everything that God stands for, we all naturally, instinctively have difficulty believing that we are accepted by God to receive the ultimate blessing merely by His mercy. We frankly don't like that idea. That's an offensive idea to us. There's a root of pride in us of some kind that desperately wants God to give us His ultimate blessing because somehow we have deserved it. Somehow we have made ourselves worthy of it. And we resist and resist and resist the contrary idea that is at the heart of the gospel. We frankly don't want to just give in and say, you know what? I'm just not worthy, and I'm never going to be worthy, God. God, if you don't have mercy on me, I'm dead. We hate that idea. And so we resist it with every fiber of our being. And in the final analysis, I think it's a miracle that any of us ever believed that. Any of us ever ever actually take that stance. And that's not just true of the non-Christians out there who haven't become Christians. I see it over and over and over again among Christians themselves. Because we talk about the mercy and grace of God, we talk about it to a blur in the face, and we will uphold it and sing about it and sing praises about it and tell other people about it. Yes, it's only by grace and only by mercy, but when you get to the real heart attitudes of us in our everyday lives, yes, it's mercy and only mercy, but he can't just give it to us to me anyway. I mean, we don't even realize the logical contradiction. Mercy by its very, if we really understand the concept, mercy by definition is something I'm not worthy of. And yet, when it comes right down to it, and if in dialogue with you, I explain to you and I assert to you that what Jesus teaches us is that eternal life is going to be mine anyway, in spite of the fact that we're not worthy of it, the most common response I'm going to get is, yeah, I know, but, and it's that, I don't think that but is an intellectual but. I think it's ultimately a personal and spiritual but. But when all is said and done, but Jack, I don't want that to be true. I don't want that to be the way it works. I resist believing that that's the way it works. Can't there be something that I can do in my life to make myself a person who's worthy of mercy? And there's the just an absolute philosophical contradiction that we don't even recognize. How could you possibly be worthy of getting something that you're not worthy of? And yet, we are so resistant to the idea that we'll embrace a contradiction before we'll accept it as true. And so we're left with three kinds of people in the world: the self-righteous hypocrite who deceives himself and just takes it for granted that he's worthy, even though everybody else knows that he's not. You have the vast majority of people who despair under the crushing burden of proving themselves worthy before God, and they just use their drug of choice to distract themselves from their despair. And then you have that third group, those few who by the supernatural miracle of God have somehow been enabled by God to overcome their natural resistance to the message of mercy and have received and accepted the mercy of God. But that's the context into which Jesus is speaking here, and obviously I will have to go on next week. So I've kept you over. Save your questions, your comments. Maybe you could be thinking about, am I totally off base when I say that Christianity today is largely Pharisaical in its essence? I mean, I'd love to have you persuade me otherwise, but I think it's worth dialogue. So I'll let you go. Thank you.